Well, hello, everyone. Thank you so much. Let me get settled here. Thank you first to Bell for bringing me here, and thank you to the Steamboat Seminars. Thank you for all of you for being here on a beautiful day like this. I'm not sure if I lived here, I would come inside to hear a speaker on a nice day like this. It's really, as I understand it, it's a great tradition, the seminar series, and it's certainly a beautiful place. So I'm honored and really pleased to be here. You did hear a little bit about me, and I wasn't sure if I would need to explain it. I am a former journalist, think tank person, book author, who in journalistic terms went over to the dark side about 8 or 9 years ago when I decided to get involved in activism and try to make something happen. And I do come directly to you from the trenches in D.C., where I worked closely with the Bush administration, with Senators McCain and Kennedy, continue to work with various Republicans and Democrats trying to move us toward better immigration law. And I now do have my own organization, which is small business owners. The reason I chose to work with small business owners is I think in some ways they're the best voice to make the case to center-right lawmakers, and that's who we need to convince, right? Democrats get it. Center-right lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, need to understand why immigrants are good for America. So I run an organization where I organize and mobilize small business owners to get into the fight and be active. And so for me, as somebody from the trenches, this is really a nice way to kind of step back and look at the big picture and have a little bit of historical perspective and ask, really, where are we and where are we going? You know, I spend my days in the minutiae of this bill and that congressman and this organization and this state. It's nice for me to have a chance to step back. So I'd like to start with, as I kind of try to get a big frame, I'd like to start with the question in the title of the lecture, the talk. Are we still a nation of immigrants? And my answer really I'm making my answer up out of two conflicting images. So the first image I'd like you to think of, and I should have one slide for this, I don't, you have to imagine it, is a graph charting the flow of immigrants to America since we first started counting in 1820. So that's a graph. It's not a straight line. It's not a set number. It's a graph with a lot of bumps in it, bumps, swells, and troughs. The first wave of immigrants came right after 1800. They were mostly Germans. Ben Franklin was all upset about them. He was very worried that the Germans were going to be so different they weren't going to fit in. Then in the 1840s and 50s, a second big wave. So the first wave was kind of a little wave. The second wave was a bigger wave. Many of our grandparents, the Germans and Irish, great-great-great-grandparents, Germans and Irish came in the 1840s and 50s. And they were considered outsiders and different then because they were mostly Catholic, coming to a Protestant country. Pretty big wave. It was the second wave, pretty big wave. Then, of course, the really big wave was the iconic Ellis Island wave, right? And that came from the 1880s to about the 1920s. And again, they were people who were very different because, by and large, at that point, Americans were northern Europeans. The Ellis Island people were from southern and eastern Europe. Again, regarded as different, hard to fit in. Could we assimilate them? And you know the story about those early waves. We all know the story. We're all brought up on it. They cleared the prairies. They built the railroads. They manned the factories that made us the industrial power, the greatest industrial power in the world. And they became 100% Americans in the foxholes of World War II. I think you all know the stories. We've all seen the movies. We've all read the books. We know about our great grandparents. But in between these swells, in between these waves, there have been valleys. So in some periods of our history, very few immigrants have come. You know, we think of ourselves as a nation of immigrants. In some periods, very few immigrants came. From the 1920s to the 1960s, very, very small numbers. A couple hundred thousand a year max, compared to over a million a year in the Ellis Island wave. So then we don't always have a lot coming. But my point here, what I'm getting at with this graph, is that right now we're in another huge wave, basically equivalent in size and percentages and impact to the Ellis Island wave. Coming after a period of relative low, a huge wave that really does rival the iconic wave. And there are differences. In the Ellis Island wave, again, we were mostly Europeans. Today, they're mostly Latinos and Asians. They're about half of today's wave is Latino, and about a quarter is Asian. But In the middle of the Ellis Island wave, about 1.2 million people came every year. Now, about 1.5 million people are coming every year. It's a little bit smaller because we have a bigger, we're a much bigger country, so it's less of a proportion, but similar numbers. As a proportion of the population, in 1910, immigrants were about 15% of the population. Today, they're about 13%. So the graph goes little wave, big wave, trough, and now another big wave. That's what we're living through, a historically big wave. And, you know, the numbers, 23% of our population right now are immigrants or immigrants' children. Nearly a quarter of the people 17 years old and younger are immigrants' children. So big impact, big story. They come mostly to work. Two-thirds of the visas are family visas, but don't let that confuse you. They're still mostly coming to do jobs. They get very little welfare, so there's no point in coming here to get welfare. In fact, even if you're legal, you don't get welfare for the first 5 years, and if you're illegal, you get no welfare. And it's much easier if you're unemployed to be unemployed at home in Mexico, right? It's warmer, you have friends and family, it's cheaper to live. So very few come for benefits. In Europe, immigrants go for benefits, but here they come to work. And they fill niches mostly at the very top of the economy, PhD scientists, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, or the bottom of the economy, agriculture, food processing, hospitality, construction. Very few come in the middle. They're high-skilled, very educated, or they're low-skilled and very uneducated. And, of course, because they're coming for work, they're coming to regions all over the country, right? In times like in the 50s when not that many immigrants were coming, they just went to a few gateway cities where there were other immigrants. Now they're going wherever there's a job as an anesthesiologist or a leaf blower, right? So there's basically no region of the country that's unaffected. And they go more to places that are growing because, again, they're going to work. So, you know, that's why Colorado, for example, since 1970, Colorado has been, you know, until recently, everything I say is until recently. Until recently, Colorado was a robustly growing state. Especially construction was a big thing here. Hospitality, obviously, agriculture. Immigrants came to work in those sectors. So undocumented immigrants, it's an easy one to measure, and they move around the most, right? They're the ones that go directly to where the jobs are. The number of undocumented immigrants in Colorado multiplied by 8 between 1970 and 2007 because they were coming here to do jobs. Immigrants total in Colorado, it's now up to about 10% of the population and about 12% of the workforce. Again, they're here to work, so they're working in even greater numbers than their percentage. And, of course, immigrant families, Hispanic and Asian families, also have more children, right, than Americans, native-born American families. So we're a nation of immigrants with big numbers, but you're going to see their share of the population grow and grow as the years go, even if we don't have any more immigrants, because they are having nearly 3 kids a family, and we're having about 2 kids a family. So in some ways, the point of this image, in some ways, it's preposterous to ask if we're still a nation of immigrants. Of course we're still a nation of immigrants. Just look around you. Immigration is part of the American DNA. And today, as in the past, we're a beacon to people all around the world who want to create a better lives for themselves and their children. And as they build these better lives, also build and strengthen America. But, and here's where I'm going to take you to the second contrasting image, right? Recently, I was giving a talk like this in Virginia, and a woman raised her hand, and she told her story. So she runs a neighborhood center in an immigrant neighborhood in Northern Virginia where she gives English classes and health advice and legal advice, you know, neighborhood center helping poor people. Just the kind of thing you want to have happen, right? People learning English, people making, you know, working out things better for their families. Well, attendance, in the last year or so, she's reporting attendance is way, way down. Fewer people are coming to the English classes. Fewer people are coming to the health clinic. Fewer people are coming to get advice about where to work. Why? Because enforcement, anti-immigration enforcement, is getting much tougher. Federal immigration enforcement and state immigration enforcement, especially in a place like Northern Virginia, high state immigration enforcement, heavy state immigration enforcement. And people are afraid to come out to any place where authorities might come and say those are immigrants. So now you can. I'm going to talk more about enforcement. I think enforcement is a good thing, but we're in a situation where, yes, we're a nation of immigrants. Yes, it's in our DNA. Yes, large numbers of people are here and are coming, but we're also in a situation where a lot of immigrants are starting to find it's not so welcoming here anymore. And the story in Virginia is just one symptom of many. You know, people like me have been trying, and the president and senators have been trying to fix the immigration system for 10 years. But we can't get the politics right. We can't get a bill passed. Anti-immigrant rhetoric is a staple in political races now across the country. Bell mentioned Tom Tancredo. Well, almost every Republican candidate, it's one of those things they tick off, you know, illegal immigrants. Enforcement is, the noose is tightening. Again, I'm for enforcement, but what we're seeing in a lot of states is enforcement deliberately designed to drive the immigrants out of the state. The theory is called attrition through enforcement. If you make their lives miserable enough, maybe they'll leave. And even Obama, right? Democratic pro-immigrant, you know, president, he's deported 1 million people since he's been president. So, again, yes, we're a nation of immigrants, but yes, it's also starting to feel less and less welcoming. Starting to feel less and less welcoming, particularly to illegal immigrants, right? But not only illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants are increasingly afraid to drive, afraid they're going to get stopped by the police, afraid to meet their kids' teachers, right? Because that's an authority who might figure out who they are. Afraid to report crimes, because, again, that's dealing with the authorities. And the point is, so illegal, unauthorized immigrants, illegal immigrants, whatever you want to call them, I use the term sort of interchangeably, they're about 28% of the immigrant population, right? Just under a third. But that other two-thirds, too, some of this climate of fear is starting to affect them. They think, well, you know, yes, it's targeted at illegal immigrants, but maybe they don't like us either. Maybe that attrition through enforcement is really because people want to drive us out as well. So even authorized immigrants, even people who have been abiding by the law, many of them, especially Latinos, are starting to feel caught in the crosshairs and starting to feel, you know, maybe Americans don't like people who are foreign or look foreign or sound foreign. So for me, these two images kind of frame the debate, frame the question. And I think they raise, you know, the important questions that we have to look at. You know, where are we? Where are we going? You know, the fundamental questions are, do we want to remain a nation of immigrants? If so, at what level? You know, do we have enough? Do we want to close the door now? Do we want to keep attracting people or stop? And at what level? If the immigration system is broken, and I'm sure you've heard that phrase, everybody, no matter what their politics, who thinks about it, far left, far right, pro-immigrant, anti-immigrant, we all think the system is broken. I mean, how could it not be broken? We have 11 million unauthorized immigrants here. Something's wrong. If you think it's broken, are we going to fix it? We've been trying for 10 years. Are we going to fix it, and when? And what are we going to do about those 11 million people? You know, can we drive them out? Do we want to drive them out? Is there some other better answer? What are we going to do about them? And even more important, what are we going to do about their children? Right? Because they have children. And some of their children are legal, and some of their children are illegal. And if we assume they're going to stay, they're going to be a big part of the workforce of tomorrow. So what are we going to do about them? So with those questions in mind, I think that's the frame. Let's step back, and let's talk a little bit about why. What's behind that graph, the big bulge we're seeing now? Why are we seeing a big bulge now? You know, why were there so few in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and there's so many now? And the answer is, it's the old answer to everything, it's the economy, stupid. Another way to think about it, lots of people who are not unhappy with immigration think somebody turned on a faucet in the 1960s. You know, Senator Kennedy turned on a faucet, and that's the source of all our problems. But the truth is, yes, there was a change in the law in the mid-60s, but much more important than that change in the law were the fundamental shifts, I like to call them tectonic plates shifting, of our economy, our educational attainment, and our demographics. So we're changing as a country in fundamental ways that are basically behind this big wave. We're having smaller and smaller families. Americans, native-born Americans, reached replacement level, fell below replacement level in the early 70s. So we're not having enough kids to replace the workforce. Baby boomers are retiring. It's been starting, but it's accelerating. They're going to retire a little more slowly now than they planned to in the past. But in the next decade, 75 million people are going to retire. Maybe most important is the difference in our education. I always say if there's one set of numbers you need to know to understand immigration, it's that in 1960, right, recently, I was alive, many of you were alive, in 1960, half of all the American men in the workforce were high school dropouts. Half. And people who were willing to do unskilled physical work, right? Today, 6% of the American men in the workforce are high school dropouts. So half to six. But we still need a lot of unskilled immigrants, a lot of unskilled workers. And meanwhile, as American workforce has been changing, the economy has been changing, so that we need more workers at both the top and the bottom. At the top, we've got the global economy now. We've got the technological change of the last couple of decades. I don't have to explain this to anyone. There's a new innovation is what makes a business prosper and grow now in a way that it never was in the past. That's the element, the magic, the secret that counts is innovation, whether it's technological innovation, entrepreneurial innovation, or managerial innovation. That's what's making the American economy great now. And so we need people, smart people from all over the world, to come give us that edge in innovation. Basically, all the countries of the world, Europe, Japan, China, India, we're all competing for those smart, high-end scientists. I mean, we grow some of our own, but we don't grow enough. Nobody grows enough. So every country is competing. In the same way that in the 19th century countries competed for territories and resources, now we're competing for like Indian PhDs and smart high-end scientists. But it's also true at the low end of the economy, at the bottom of the job ladder, we also don't have enough people. You know, think about a couple of examples. Think about the family dairy farm, right? Kids grow up on that dairy farm. Dad was willing to be a dairy farmer and stay there and farm milk the cows every day. Kids are not. Kids want to go to get to the city. Kids want to go to college. Think about fast food restaurants. Women have gone to the workforce. Fast food restaurants, you know, think about what it was like in 1960. How many fast food restaurants were there? We've had an explosion of fast food restaurants. Well, who's going to work in them? Some kids, but not enough. Or think about meatpacking is the other kind of quintessential example. In the 50s, meatpacking was a pretty skilled job. A knife man was what they called the guy, and he made $20 an hour. Well, now meatpacking plants have to compete with meatpacking plants in Brazil, where people don't make very much, and it all goes by on a conveyor belt, and you make the same stab in every carcass, and it's a minimum wage job. Well, Americans aren't going to do it. So who are going to do these? We have as much need at the low end as we have at the high end. One of my opponents, he likes to say, somebody I debate frequently, he likes to say, oh, there, you know, Tamar, there she goes again. Her answer for the American economy is importing more high school dropouts. And, you know, it's funny, but I cop to it. You know, we do. We need more PhD scientists, but we also need unskilled workers. We don't have enough. And the point is that these fundamental shifts, these economic, educational, demographic trends, they're not changing that much in the downturn. I mean, of course, you know, there's some Americans who, I mean, there are many Americans unemployed. There are many Americans taking a job a few rungs down. But you can't go from being an unemployed auto worker to being an engineer, a software engineer, you know, in a year. We can't make more Indian PhDs. And arguably, as we rethink and restructure our economy, we're going to need more of those high-end immigrants, even in the downturn. And even at the low end, I mean, again, you would think, well, now people are going to be willing to go take the farm jobs. But the truth is, they're not. If you're, Detroit, if you're making whatever you were making in the auto plants, you're not going to get in your car and drive across the state and clean toilets in a hotel for a summer job. So agriculture, seasonal work, the back-breaking low-end service jobs, they still need workers. They still, Americans are not showing up to fill them. And they're regions of the country. A friend of mine, a New York Times reporter, just reported a story in Louisiana. Well, pretty good jobs in Louisiana can't find workers because everybody in Louisiana is working in the oil rigs. So different kinds of jobs, different regions, still needing low-end workers even in the downturn. And the point is that the immigration is very market responsive, right? So you're the immigrant you're the immigrant at home in your village in Mexico, and your cousin calls you and he says, well, there are no jobs in construction anymore. Nobody's building any houses. But by the way, I hear there's still a job in the seasonal resort in wherever. But in the downturn, there's been enough communication back and forth that the flow is way down. And the numbers in many places are shrinking. So in Colorado, for example, just in the last couple of years, your undocumented population has dropped by 15% because everyone knows there's no construction jobs here. So it's market responsive. That's good. But the point is that when the economy comes back up again, we're again going to need significant numbers of even unskilled immigrants. And the bottom line here, the point about this economic story, is that basically these immigrants are good for us. They're good for American businesses, and they're good for the U.S. economy. They're not taking jobs from Americans. They complement Americans, because we're in that big middle of the economic spectrum. We're not at the low end. We're not at the top end, most of us. And because we have people at the low end and the top end, that actually makes Americans more productive and creates jobs for Americans. You can see how it works at the high end, right? The guy who invented the Pentium chip was an Indian. Guy who started Google, one of the two founders, was Russian. One quarter of the doctors in America today are foreign-born. A quarter of the doctors. A quarter of the nurses. A quarter of the patents taken out in America today are from foreign-born people. So those high-end people are really driving our innovation. One half of the PhD scientists in America today are foreign-born. And 25% of the high-end companies, the startups, started in the boom years from 1995 to 2005 were started by immigrants. So, our economy would look very, very different if we didn't have those high-end immigrants. But the low end, too, and again, here's this kind of counterintuitive, why do we need more busboys? Imagine, the example I like to use is imagine you're an investor in London, and you're trying to decide, am I going to open a restaurant in New York, or am I going to open a restaurant in Japan? And, they've got advantages to both, but one of the points about Japan is they don't like immigrants, and they have the same demographic issues we have, right? People are getting more educated. People don't want to do unskilled work. People are getting older in the workforce. So they don't have any immigrants. So busboys and low-end help is very, very expensive in Japan. In the U.S., it's much cheaper. So you open your restaurant in New York. Well, that means jobs and more work for the people growing the food in New York instead of in Japan, the people processing the food in America instead of in Japan, the people trucking the food in America instead of in Japan, the guy building the restaurant in America instead of Japan, the busboys, the waiters, the chefs, the bank that's giving them the financing. So up and down the chain, ripple effects, low-end workers, busboys, are actually making it possible for Americans with very different skills to have more work and be more productive. So I think we see the picture. We've got a big flow. There are economic benefits from both the high and the low end. Of course, there are also costs, right? Nothing is all benefits. Economists have been looking for a long time, are they taking jobs for Americans? I mean, in my theory, where they're complementary, it doesn't suggest they'd be taking very many. But a lot of economists are skeptical. People are skeptical. People think, my cousin might do that job if they just paid a dollar more. So economists have been looking, are they taking jobs? Find very little evidence of displacement. I mean, really virtually none. They do find modest wage effects. So not for... And again, the point here is complementarity, right? For the people who are complementary to the immigrant workers, actually, immigrants have helped raise wages. For the people who are exactly like immigrants, high school dropouts, they've lowered wages somewhat. But, again, economists are looking, trying to figure out how much. Even that lowering of the wages is very modest. It's like 1% to 2% over, 20 years. So it's real. It's real, but it's not that much. More important, I would argue, than the wage effect is the dislocation. I mean, let's face it, if you're a town that didn't have any immigrants 20 years ago and suddenly you go from 0 to 60, somebody builds a meatpacking plant or the construction takes off and suddenly your town is full of immigrants, that's going to be dislocating. There's going to be a lot of Spanish in the supermarket and there are a lot more poor people around and it's going to be a different experience. And that's an issue. These are costs. It's also true that immigrants, many of them pay taxes, even illegal immigrants pay taxes. They get it taken out of their paycheck or what have you. They pay property tax through their rent. They pay sales tax. And so they do pay taxes. The Social Security Administration ends up every year with $7 billion that it can't figure out what account to put it in because it came to an account where the name doesn't match. There's no real number. $7 billion extra in the Social Security fund. But... the taxes are going to the federal level, most of them. They're not going that much to the local level. But it's at the local level that you have to provide the services. So who's paying for the hospital? Who's paying for the schools? Who's paying for all the things that go with having more poor people around? So that's a problem. The split of the money's going to the wrong place. And I think the worst problem, I think sort of no matter what your political values, I think the worst problem is the illegality, right? 11 million people here. That's the size of like Ohio or Pennsylvania on the wrong side of the law. And so let's step back a second and look at the, to understand the illegality, you have to go back to the economy, to the economic story. The point is the supply and demand I talked about, the need for workers and the availability nearby, that generates in the boom time, it's a little bit different now, but in the boom time, that generated until 2007, that generated about 1.5 million net inflow every year, 1.5 million. But meanwhile, we were giving out 1 million visas. So, you know, 1.5 million flow, 1 million visas. Of necessity, 500,000 were unauthorized. And it's a little bit like the analogy for me. It's a little bit like we were making cars here and we needed to import the steel, but our steel quotas were a third too low. Well, how dopey would that be? I mean, yes, the people broke the law, but we were saying, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, come on, we need you. They were building houses. You know, arguably, I would say the housing boom wouldn't have happened. But we were also saying, you know, it's against the law, but people came. So 1.5 million supply and demand, 1 million visas. And the point is, for that 500,000 in the gap, there was no way to come. It's not like they wanted to come illegally. They could have come legally. They just wanted to do it the tricky way. There weren't visas for them. If you're a Mexican and you want year-round work and you don't have family here, there's basically no visa for you. So you come illegally. And I think, you know, the consequence, no matter what you think about what they did, and we can, you know, yes, they wrote the law. We can talk about what they did and how you should remedy it. The consequences are a travesty, no matter what your political values are. You know, if you're upset that they broke the law, it's a travesty. It's an outrage. If you're worried about the porous border, it's an outrage. It's a travesty. It's a nightmare. It's frightening. If you're worried about, if you've got liberal values and you're worried about 11 million people living amongst us but not in the society and not enfranchised, that's a travesty. And again, and you're going to hear me come back to this again and again, the kids growing up of these families, the kids, what's going to happen to these kids? You know, immigrants, unauthorized immigrants live on the run. They change jobs all the time. They earn less. They fear authorities. And of course that's going to affect their kids. Somebody did a study in California a couple years ago where they compared two groups. The parents were people who started out illegal, both sets of parents, and one set of fathers had legalized in the amnesty of the 80s. Well, the difference was the people whose fathers had so equally poor families, the kids of the fathers who had not legalized were 25% more likely to drop out, 60%, 70% less likely to go to college, less likely to learn good English, less likely to have good productive jobs. So, you know, big consequence for us, travesty. Whatever your values, the illegal population is really a disaster. So, you know, for me, from the point of view of policy, okay, we've got this reality, the big flow. It's giving enormous benefits to the country. It's also got serious costs. Is there a policy that where we can reconcile some of this, accept this reality, come to grips with it? If we need the workers, let's acknowledge it, but maximize the costs and minimize the benefits. Another way to put it, same question phrased a little bit differently, or it's a little bit different question, do we have a moral responsibility? If these workers are coming, if our economy is generating this demand and these people are coming and it's benefiting us, yes, they broke the law. Yes, they broke the law. But, you know, I would argue there are kind of two signs at the border. There's one sign that says keep out, but there's another sign that says help wanted. And do we have a moral responsibility to reconcile those signs and to come to grips with the people already here, to recognize their contribution, to allow them to earn their way onto the right side of the law? I don't want to just wave a wand and say it doesn't matter that you broke the law, but a way to have them make restitution and earn their way onto the right side of the law, and to live and work here in dignity. And my argument is that we do, that the answer to both of these questions is yes. This is exactly what we need. We need a solution that comes to grips with the economic reality, maximizes the benefits and minimizes the costs, and a solution that gives the country a better way to align our economic needs and our economic benefits with our moral and political values. I mean, I don't want to live in a country where 11 million people are living on the wrong side of the law. So this is exactly what comprehensive immigration reform, I'm sure you've heard the term, was supposed to do. You all read the paper. I'm sure you read about it in 2006 and 2007. President Bush and, you know, senators as diverse as Senator Edward Kennedy and Senator John McCain came up with this answer that was meant to be a compromise answer that was meant to address both of these dimensions that I've just talked about. And, you know, very odd bedfellows. There was no more liberal member of the Senate than Senator Kennedy. And, you know, President Bush, they're probably more conservative Republicans than he, but pretty conservative. And they developed this consensus over the years. And it basically had three pillars. So I'm going to explain what those three pillars are. Basically, I'll just count them off first and then go into depth. Better enforcement. Visas for workers so that we close that gap between the 1.5 million demand and the 1 million visas, and some reasonable answer, some realistic workable answer for the 11 or 12 million. Now, I want to be clear before I go into the details, comprehensive immigration reform, you know, it's not happening anytime soon. President Obama is going to talk about it between now and November. It's not going to happen. It's probably dead as we know it, that big package. You know, I think healthcare kind of killed big packages. So when I talk about the three pillars, I'm going to talk about the ideal, but I'm also going to talk about some less, you know, some other ways we might get at it. Pillar number one is enforcement. And you need enforcement both on the border and the workplace. Border, it's what gets most attention. Obviously, it's important. I don't think the answer is a fence. I think the answer is more men, more technology to screen where people are coming in, better coordination, equipment to do that coordination. Also very important is a judicial process where it used to be that people would just come in and if they caught you, they would just send you back and you would go home the next day. Now you have to be fingerprinted and go through, see a judge, and that's actually has a big deterrent effect. So in a way, more important than the equipment or certainly than the fence, which isn't going to stop anyone, is the judicial process. And the border is very important, but the workplace is even more important. And the point about the workplace, because you're only going to, you know, Janet Napolitano, before she ran the DHS, she used to say, show me a 50-foot fence and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. And so the point is, you know, physical barrier is only going to do so much. But the workplace, you know, if unauthorized people can't work, that's really going to be a deterrent. People are not going to want to come. If you can't work, there's no point in coming. So what you need in the workplace is a combination. Just enforcement wouldn't be good because then, like, companies wouldn't have enough workers. You need a combination of an adequate supply of workers, a way to hire the workers you need legally. And yes, you know, definitely employers should have to try to find American workers first. There should be really strict laws and procedures they should have to go through, and they should make sure there's no American who wants to do the job. But then, if they can't find Americans, they should have a quick, easy way to get the workers. And you know, they shouldn't make the choice. Do I break the law or grow my business, which is the choice we give them now? Try to find Americans. If you can't, you should be able to get legal immigrant workers. But that has to be combined with tough enforcement in the workplace that prevents them from hiring illegal workers, that screens out the illegal workers, that prevents them from getting hired, and that punishes the employers who do hire them. So it's a combination of an adequate flow and punishment if you do the wrong thing. And, you know, we can go into the details and the technology of how we have workplace enforcement. Right now, there's an internet system. It's called E-Verify. You can go on the internet and figure out if the guy in front of you is legal or not. Other people talk about a swipe card with biometrics in it. You know, I think it should be the best that technology can deliver. I think it should work. And there is a bill that you might hear about that is going to get debated probably in the fall that would make E-Verify mandatory for all businesses in the country. That will be a big, dramatic step. I don't think it'll pass the Senate, but you'll read about it in the news. And the interesting thing is that business actually, the Chamber of Commerce and my organization and other business groups, we're supporting mandatory E-Verify because we think worksite enforcement is part of the answer. Businesses are, most employers you're going to find are not the bad apple employers who want to break the law, but there are most businesses just want legal workers. And the point is that this work site enforcement is a key part of the solution, but it's not the whole solution because you also need the second pillar, which are these visas for workers. Again, you have to close that gap between whatever our need is at any given time and the supply so that people have a legal way to come, so that people, they try to hire Americans first, but then they have a recourse. And, you know, there's a big argument. Democrats would prefer that they were permanent visas. Republicans would prefer that they're temporary visas. Business actually would like them. I would like them. I'm trying to convince others in the business world. Short-term visas first that you can then convert to a permanent visa. I mean, this is all the details. The big question is really how many. And, you know, I think it should be what the economy needs. Employers should be forced to make every effort to hire Americans, and they should give American workers every kind of adequate protection, wage protections and others. But then they should be able to. We should have enough of a legal flow that people can get workers. And of course, the point about this is that that flow will fluctuate in good and bad economic times. Right? Right now, it would be a lot smaller. We don't need as many. We don't need any construction workers. We still need farm workers, but we don't need construction workers. So right now it would be pretty small. In good times, the pipeline would grow again. And the point is, no matter what the size, is that they would be legal workers. And, you know, the legalization part of the amnesty part, I don't use that word, but the amnesty part of the solution, the third pillar, that's the most controversial. But this is actually the most important. This is fixing the immigration system so that it works. The best answer to illegal immigration is a legal immigration system that works. The only real way to get effective enforcement is realistic limits, is a realistic pipeline. And the only way really to avoid another 11 or 12 million unauthorized people in a decade from now is a legal system that works. So, you know, I would argue that the second pillar is really the heart of it. But of course, we have to get to the third pillar, and you know that's what do we do about the 11 million people already here? And the point about those 11 million people is that most of them are not going home. Yes, the ones who got here recently, who haven't had that successful a time here, who didn't really find work or found work, and now they're unemployed. We might be able to drive them home if we really tried. We're not going to deport 11 or 12 million people. I mean, just the cost, you know, would be unbelievable. Not to mention the TV images of Americans rounding up people and deporting 11 million people. So the question is, what are we going to do with the people who've, you know, been here 10 to 15 years? You know, they're married to a legal immigrant. They probably have kids who are citizens. They probably own property. They have a job. And I argue that it's for our sake, as much as for their sake, that we have to give them a way to get on, to earn their way onto the right side of the law. I'm not doing it out of altruism, right? I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative. I'm doing it for security reasons. These are 11 million people whose real names we don't even know. They've never been through a background check. You know, think of what kind of haven for terrorists that is. And for economic reasons. I think we need the workers. When they legalize, they're much more productive. I mean, this is what happened in the 80s when we legalized 3 million people. They learn English faster. They invest in upgrading their skills. They become much more productive workers. And again, think about their kids. I'm going to come back to their kids, but think about their kids. And so the question really for me is, you know, will the public accept legalization, some kind of legalization program, and can Congress pass it? And, you know, basically everybody from from Senator Kennedy to President Bush, agreed that these people had to earn their way onto the right side of the law. Nobody's saying wave a wand, make them legal, forget that they did something wrong. Everybody agrees that they have to jump through some kind of hoops, learning English, paying taxes, maybe paying a fine, continuing to work, maybe going home first. I mean, people have all kinds of different hoops they think of. And really the main question to me is what hoops exactly? You know, when we get to this, how strict are the hoops going to be? And then there's another question, are they going to get to be legal only, or can they also become citizens? And, you know, increasingly, I think we all used to say they have to all become citizens. I think in some new, more realistic mood, I think, it may turn out that they just become legalized. But what we don't know is, and I'm running out of time, I didn't realize how late it was, what we don't know is, you know, we've been trying this for 10 years. We've been trying to get this reform passed for 10 years. If anything, it's been getting harder. Public resistance has been seeming to get harder. So we don't know what's politically doable. What kind of answer can we come up with for these 11 million? So I wanted to talk a little bit about public opinion, but I do see I'm running out of time. I mean, the basic story about public opinion is that public opinion is the biggest obstacle to getting to a rational answer here. You know, I've laid out a very rational case. I've laid out a rational solution. It's a Democrat-Republican compromise. But Congress just can't vote for it because public opinion you remember the outcry in 06 and 07. Public opinion, amnesty, can't do it, can't go there. Obviously, the downturn has made it harder for members of Congress even to consider immigration, right? They've got a lot more pressing things on their plate, and nobody's thinking about immigration. But if they were to try to address it now, I think you would, what you would find is Democrats are very – it's very polarized. It's become something Democrats are trying to do and boasting to to Latino voters that they're trying to do, while Republicans have gotten even more and more opposed. I mean, in a way, Bush was the Nixon who went to China who made it possible and safe for Republicans to be for it. Now it's not really possible or safe for Republicans to be for it, and so Congress hasn't been able to do it. And the public, you know, when you poll the public on comprehensive immigration reform, they actually poll pretty favorably. I mean, if you say we're going to combine enforcement with a way for unauthorized workers to earn their way onto the right side of the law, you get about between two-thirds and three-quarters saying that they're for it. I mean, that's pretty good polling. But that extra third are very angry and vocal and mobilized. And even the people who say they're for it have anxieties about immigrants, right? You know, whether it's economic, whether it's they think they're taking their job, whether it's whether it's that they snuck in, you know, that's one thing people think. They could have come the legal way, or, you know, they're taking a job that my cousin could have if somebody just paid a dollar more, or they're living on welfare benefits and not paying taxes, or they're not integrating. And, you know, as we saw, none of those things are actually true, right? The immigrants didn't choose to sneak in. There is no line for that half a million who come illegally. The immigrants aren't living on welfare and not paying taxes. Many fewer immigrants use any kind of government benefits than similarly poor and uneducated Americans. And a lot of them are paying taxes. And they are actually assimilating. I mean, everybody thinks, you know, my grandmother learned English overnight, but today nobody's learning English. Actually, that's not true. There's a terrific study that I just learned about has been done that looked at what percentage of the immigrant population learned English in the first 5 years in the 20 years between 1880 and 1900, okay? What percent learned English in the first 5 years? Well, in those days, it was half. Today, it's three quarters. So they're learning English faster. That image about my grandmother did it and they're not doing it today, they're actually learning English faster. And they're also, you know, they are moving up economically. When they come, they're very poor, they're very uneducated, they make less than similar American workers. Within 20 years, they're making more than the people they started out with, similar American workers. Within 20 years, they're more likely to own a home than similar American workers. They're much more likely to have started a business within 20 years. 90% of the kids speak English very well. So, you know, we all think, we have this image of they're not integrating, they're not assimilating, but the truth is they are. And so the public's fears on all these counts, you know, that they snuck in, that they're living on welfare, that they're not learning English, that they're not playing by the rules, the public's fears are not based in fact, but, you know, fact and emotion, usually when you have a conflict between fact and emotion, emotion wins. And people are very emotional about this. So in closing, you know, where does this leave us? Well, you know, we've said, you know, number one, I've established a few things, right? Immigration is a given of the modern globalized world, right? Planet is shrinking, interconnected labor markets, people are going to move. They're going to come and take jobs if we have jobs. By and large, number two, it's good for us. It's good for American businesses, good for the American economy, good for American workers because the immigrants are complementary. Number three, we know what needs to be done, right? Comprehensive immigration reform. Like, the answer's been pretty well worked out by now. You know, it's like the Middle East. Like, everybody says we know what the solution is. We just can't get there. And number four, the problem is the gap between basically public – the problem is public opinion and politics, the broken political system that can't get to a solution, and the public uneasiness about the immigrants, public emotional sphere and uneasiness about the immigrants. But I believe, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years, and it's gotten more and more frustrating. I won't pretend it hasn't. I still think we are going to get there. I basically think we have to get there. You know, it's a question that's like, how long can you live in a house where the roof is leaking or the heating system doesn't work? You know, eventually you fix it. And I would argue that Americans in particular, you know, some other countries, maybe they put it off and put it off. Eventually, I think America's sort of pragmatic, can-do, grapple with the issues. I think we will grapple with this. And I think there are two things in particular that are going to prod us to grapple with it. I mean, yes, well, two things are going to prod us. The first is the chaos in the states. And I haven't talked about this, but since the government failed to solve this in 06 and 07, basically every state in the nation has come up with its own version of immigration law, tried to pass its own version of immigration law. And it's a total contradictory mess, because about half of them are passing tougher and tougher and tougher enforcement designed to drive people out, and the other half are passing like things to make life easier, like college tuition for the kids of illegal immigrants. So you've got this conflict between the tough laws and the favorable laws, and you've got suits coming up out of every state. Somebody's suing, whoever it is suing. If they don't like the tough law, they're suing against that. If they don't like the nice law, they're suing against that. And so the courts, more chaos. And every little ratchet of chaos puts more pressure on Congress and the president to act. So that's one thing that's pressing us. But the second thing that's pressing us, and here I've been sort of building to this, trying to build to it, is the children of today's immigrants. So there are 1 million unauthorized immigrant children in America today. There are 8 million kids of unauthorized parents. This is the workforce of tomorrow. This is a workforce that we can't afford to waste. I don't think we can afford to have them anything less, to give them anything less than the best possible educations. And, you know, let's be clear, like, they start out at the bottom of the educational ladder, right? These are kids of poor immigrants with no, you know, many parents have never, don't know how to read, not been to school. So there's a real risk there if they're not educated. We've got a lot of ground to cover in any case in getting them educated, as educated as we need them to be for the 21st century American economy. And we can't afford to raise them or the other young Latinos who identify with them and empathize with them. We can't afford to raise them angry and alienated. And these are selfish reasons I'm talking about, right? This isn't altruism. I'm talking about our economy and our social fabric. But that's good, right? Because when people have to do something for selfish reasons, they usually do it, as opposed to altruism. They don't always do it. And my point is that our self-interest is driving us urgently to deal with this. And personally, this was driven home to me, and I'm going to end with this last image. I went to give a talk like this at Berkeley in 06, at the height of the immigration debate. And so, you know, you turn on O'Reilly, or you turn on Rush Limbaugh, or you turn on whoever it was. They were railing at immigrants. Bitter debate. And there was a young Latino kid guiding me around the campus. And he waited until we had a moment when we were by ourselves. I forget if it was before the talk or after the talk. But he kind of, you know, he had this personal question he had to ask me. And so what he said, Tamar, why is the debate so bitter? Why is this debate so bitter? And I forget what I told him, you know, it was some answer about politics. And you know, he was very, very emotional. My political answer wasn't good enough. He said, no, that's not what I mean. I'll never forget this, really. He said, why do Americans hate us so much? This kid, this was a second-generation kid. He was born here. He was legal. His parents, he was middle class. He grew up in a suburb somewhere in California. He was going to one of the best universities of the world, right, Berkeley. He had a bright future, bright for him and bright for us. He was going to be an incredible asset in America. But he was taking the anti-immigrant rhetoric he was hearing on TV personally. And it was going to have, you know, potentially serious negative consequences for him and for how much of an asset he was going to be to America if he was angry and alienated. And so for me, you know, net bottom line, I believe that before long, these pressures, the chaos in the states, which is going to get worse and worse for the next couple of years, and this question of the workforce of tomorrow, these children, are going to force us to act and do something about this problem. They're going to force Congress and the American people to wrestle with immigration policy and fix it. And fix it in the way that I talked about, find ways to accept the reality, maximize the benefits, minimize the cost, and align our values, our political and moral values, with our economic needs. And so the question for me, you know, is how long it's going to take and what we can do to speed it up. And, you know, people in my allies in Washington, they used to say, you know, they tease me. They say she does a lot of things in our coalition. The most important is that she's the optimist. But, I mean, I do optimistically believe that our DNA as a nation of immigrants and our pragmatism to grapple with problems is going to win out in the end. The question for us today is what exactly we can do to speed that up. And I think it's a question for me, but it's also a question for you as citizens. So Now, you take charge of the question?
I will try to, yes. We have a lot of questions coming in now.
So try to be short.
One is on what is your position on the status of children who are born in the U.S. to illegal immigrants and the possibility that eventually they will become anchor babies, quote unquote, for more immigrants?
Very few people come to America to have babies, come in an unauthorized way to have babies so that they can later sponsor their parents. I mean, if you're poor, like, what would you do all in that meantime, right? You'd have to work for 18 years before the kid could even sponsor you, right? Middle-class people. I know Mexican middle-class people who come to American hospitals and have babies so their kids can go to Harvard, but it's very rare. I mean, you hear about unauthorized women having babies in hospitals in Texas or California. That's because there are a lot of unauthorized women living in Texas and California, and they have babies. Very few poor people. There's very little evidence that poor women come illegally to America to have babies. I do think that if people are going to live here and stay here and grow up in America to be our workforce, we need to figure out a way to authorize them and get them the best education possible and make them feel as much of the country as possible for all the reasons I said. But I also think we could have sanctions. We could have figured out some way to have sanctions against birth tourism. I mean, people who come for 2 weeks to have a baby, we could figure out some way to say, no, that person doesn't get to be a citizen. I could go along with that. But I'm not for rescinding birthright citizenship or, keeping people who are going to live here forever on the margins of society.
So you've talked a lot about public opinion and how it's hampering efforts to do what you think would be sensible. So how do we change public opinion? What is business and the groups you work with doing to try to change public opinion? And what other kind of creative ways might we work on this? Can we have a Latino spring in which undocumented immigrants themselves would speak out about their status? Or try to change public opinion through Facebook or something like this?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't do what I do anymore. I would have done it. The point about public opinion is that if you get people thinking pragmatically, they do see what the solution is. I mean, it's worth going into this for a minute. It's a little bit longer answer, but I do a lot of focus groups, right? One of the things I sponsor in my organization is focus groups, where you go to listen to people talk about immigration. So you get, you're behind a one-way mirror, and you've got 10 or 12 or 14 people in the room talking about the subject. I like to joke, I can't think of any more fun way to spend an evening, but people think that's, something wrong with my life. But if you go in a focus group and you just say, do you think immigrants are good for America or bad for America? At the beginning, it's mixed. I think they can think of a few good things. But then they get onto the thing of the bad things. And they go and they go and they go. And it's the hospital emergency room. And it's this, what used to be a music teacher in my kids' school is now a bilingual education teacher. And they're using the welfare and they're not paying taxes. And if you just let them talk, good or bad, and you wait for let the 2 hours elapse, by the end of the 2 hours, they're like coming through the mirror at you. They get angrier and angrier and angrier. If you say, after like 10 minutes of that, well, what's your solution? We've got 11 million people here. We've got 12 million people here. We've got companies that need the workers. What's your solution? People get very pragmatic very fast. So first they say, well, let's deport them all. And everybody says, yeah, good idea. And so they talk about that for about 10 minutes amongst themselves. And believe me, I'm not in the room. You couldn't put me in that room. But they talk about it amongst themselves. Could we deport them? And after about 20 minutes, and I've seen this again and again and again, all kinds of groups, after about 20 minutes, they get to, well, it wouldn't really be that practical to deport them. Like, how would we find them, and wouldn't it be expensive, and how would we round them up? Can't do that. So then somebody says, okay, so let's just make it so miserable here that they all go home. And, I mean, you laugh, but that's what they're doing in 15 states, right? Attrition through enforcement. And somebody says, yeah, really good idea. They talk about that for about 10 minutes. It only takes them about 10 minutes this time. And at the end they get to, well, it's not that practical. Would they go home if they've lived here 15 years? Besides, who would mow my lawn? At 10 minutes. 45-minute point, and I'm not kidding, you can time your watch. Tell the time by it. Somebody says, I hate to say this, don't tell my husband, I can't believe it's me saying this. I think we have to figure out a way for them to get legal. They're going to have to jump through some kind of hoops, we're going to have to make them pay some penalties, but there's no other answer. And everybody basically agrees. Usually one person holds out, somebody's really angry. But the point is, if you can get people thinking pragmatically, you can get there. If we could educate them about you know, all these things that they have wrong, that my cousin would do the job if we paid a dollar more, that they're taking welfare and not paying the taxes, you know, that they're not integrating, that they'd rather speak Spanish, you know. I mean, no one would rather that their kids speak Spanish. Everyone knows that their kids are going to get ahead by learning English. If we could put aside, so I think it's partly about education. It's partly about puncturing some of those myths. And that's a, you know, national process. It's partly about getting people thinking pragmatically. And then it's about having the politics that work, right? Because public opinion by itself doesn't work unless the politics work. And right now, I mean, I tried not to go into politics because I sort of told, you know, it's supposed to be policy. The politics are really broken. And immigration has sort of become, you know, like the new abortion. You know, it's like you're for it, you're against it. Never change your mind. The two sides can't talk to each other. And, you know, LBJ used to have a saying. He used to ask lawmakers, do you want a solution? Do you want a bill? Or do you want an issue? And a bill meant a solution, a compromise. An issue meant something that you can go home and campaign on, raise money on, get votes on. Well, immigration went from being an issue, a bill thing. You know, when Bush days it was a bill. Now it's an issue. Both sides take it home and campaign on it. So, you know, we both have to change public opinion, and we have to somehow get back, cross the line back, put the toothpaste back in the tube, get back from being a wedge issue to being something that they're trying to work on. And that's the challenge, really.
I think the issue is that you've been awake for most of the past 24 hours, and the solution is to thank you and call this to a close.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.